We are here today to lay to rest a potentially powerful antidepressant combination, one that utilized the pharmacologic synergy of dual serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake, sometimes called by its scientific name, venlafaxine and tazepine combination, sometimes called California Rocket Fuel. Welcome to the Carlat Psychiatry Podcast, brought to you by the Carlat Psychiatry Report, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlat Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a student psych NP and a dedicated reader of every issue.
Sometimes a catchy name can make a bigger difference than a solid finding in psychiatric research. That was the case with the antidepressant combination of venlafaxine, Effexor, and mirtazapine, Remeron, which Stephen Stahl dubbed California Rocket Fuel. The research was thin on this treatment, the numbers were very small, and there wasn't much controlled data at all, but the idea caught on. So much so that it became practically a standard treatment in psychiatry. It was even in the algorithm for the famous STAR-D trial. Many of us have used it, I know I certainly have. Many of us have believed in it, in part because it has a mechanism of action that's just so inherently interesting. In our September issue, we describe three large studies recently released and one of them still unpublished that puts this treatment to rest. In this podcast, we're going to talk a little more about where do we go from here.
It's sad to see a treatment that brought hope for so many people come to an end. I'll never forget Stephen Stahl's vivid description of what this treatment could do for people. This combination is sometimes called California Rocket Fuel, he wrote, because of the potentially powerful antidepressant action blasting the patient out of the depths of depression. And it was such a cool name, California Rocket Fuel. What other treatment in psychiatry has such a cool name like that? Baby, California
Rocket Fuel. In our last podcast, we talked about another common treatment that's crumbled, paroxetine for anxiety disorders. And just like that, this one on mirtazapine and venlafaxine not working, that was hard to take in because I know myself, I've seen many patients get better on it. I certainly believe that it worked. There was small, and now it seems very small in retrospect, data supporting it. But I also have to remember that about 30 to 40% of what we see and what we do every day is the placebo effect, so I really can't trust my own experience on this one. I've got to trust the numbers. So my take on it is three large studies in a row, I got to believe that. But now I'm thinking, as I go back to the office, what do I do with all my patients who are already on this combination? And the answer will be different for everyone. But one thing I'll do is I won't assume that they need both drugs, and I'll certainly keep a much more open mind that they may be responding to just the mirtazapine or just the venlafaxine and not both. And I would slowly peel one of those away depending on which one is causing the most side effects.
But there's good news here. I can see how patients could benefit from taking away either of these meds. Both cause weight gain. Of course, mirtazapine is more infamous of the two. 30 to 75% of those who take mirtazapine gain a significant amount of weight. But Effexor is not completely innocent here either. In the case of Effexor, the weight gain is not really noticed. It's a slow build over the years.
Thinking about that they can both cause weight gain, if I had no idea which of these meds was necessary, I might actually be inclined to take away the venlafaxine first.
But why is that?
Well, venlafaxine is the only one of the two that causes sexual side effects.
Oh.
And we often think about weight as a medical problem because we know we have copious research that obesity is bad for health. And it wasn't always this way in society, like back in the days of the Rubens paintings. A healthy person was seen as being round and rotund and obese. But today, we don't look on obesity with those eyes. We look on it as something that's quite unhealthy and it's not something we want to do to our patients. And all of that comes from the epidemiologic research on obesity. The reason I'm harping on this is that we don't have that kind of research for sex. And think about it. What happens when we give a medication that obliterates sex drive in 60% of patients for years and years? What is that doing to their health?
There's a little bit of research showing the health benefits of sex, although we have tons of it on exercise, obesity, and diet. Sex improves immune function, lowers blood pressure, and raises estrogen and testosterone. In one study, men who had sex at least twice a week were half as likely to die of heart disease as men who rarely had sex. And it improves sleep, which is another reason to consider mirtazapine.
It's amazing how little research there is on something that evolution would have us believe is so central to health and physiology. In men, sex reduces the risk of prostate cancer, and in women, it lowers the risk of breast cancer. And like we talked about in one of our May podcasts, it reduces the risk of depression.
Despite the bad news about California rocket fuel, mirtazapine remains a very useful medication as it treats a number of psychiatric disorders. And you can learn more about its many uses in the September edition.
Most of those are covered in the article, but as a supplement to our readers, I want to mention two other myths about mirtazapine. One is that it treats akathisia. It's true that mirtazapine doesn't cause much akathisia, and it is true that it treats it, but it only treats akathisia in doses 15 milligrams and below, while doses 15 milligrams and above can cause akathisia. The other myth, and this one's a bit obscure, but I had heard a number of sleep experts promote mirtazapine around 10 years ago as a good option for people with sleep apnea. Now, that may sound paradoxical on the face of it, like why would you give a medication that causes obesity to someone with sleep apnea? But this was another one of those cases where it made a certain amount of neurotransmitter sense. That is, we knew from mirtazapine's neurotransmitter effects that it loosens soft tissue in the pharynx, thereby opening the airwaves and allowing people with sleep apnea to breathe better. The problem was that effect, be it real, didn't seem to make any difference in several large studies that tested this out. Bottom line, and perhaps it is because it causes waist gain or because of other reasons, giving mirtazapine to people with sleep apnea did not help their sleep apnea one bit and probably isn't a good reason to use it.
Join us next week for an expert interview on psychopharmacology with Nasir Gami.
You can read the full articles and get access to all articles on our website, thecarlettereport.com, where we have a special offer for our podcast listeners. You can get $30 off your annual subscription with the code PODCAST, all in uppercase.
The subscription includes the print edition delivered to your mailbox and full access to all the articles on the website, monthly CME credits to maintain licensure, as well as an option for self-assessment credits toward your board certification.
The Carlatt Report is one of few CME publications that depends entirely on subscribers for our support. That helps us stay free of the influence of the pharmaceutical industry and bring you information you can trust. Baby, California, look at you.